Such system can have a stronger economy compared to others. I think money is a big issue. It's a very important.
Ancient Rome is the representative case where the empire's history followed the ups and downs of currency. Once ancient Rome expanded to the Mediterranean Sea, the circulation range of the currency did as well. The expansion of the local currency led to stronger national power through the acquisition of local resources. Periods of stable prices and a booming economy coincide with the peak of the Roman Empire. In 54 AD, the peaceful reign of the Roman Empire ended under Emperor Nero. Nero reduced the amount of gold used in coins and made thinner, smaller ones. His successors also degraded the coins, and the value of money plunged. The currency system completely collapsed, and the government had to collect taxes through goods and services instead of money. The strong empire had reverted back to the time of the exchange of goods. In 476 AD, the thousand-year-old civilization of the Roman Empire collapsed. Even after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire continued to flourish and survived for another 1,000 years. The secret to the survival of the Byzantine Empire, despite frequent battles, was the bezant, the Byzantine coin. However, after the Crusades, even the value of the bezant plunged. In 1453, the Byzantine Empire fell when the last bezant was used up. The Byzantine Empire disappeared along with the bezant, and the Ottoman Turks became the rulers of a new empire. The special relationship between the fall of a currency and an empire can also be seen in China. During the Bukong dynasty, people in Sichuan made coins out of iron. At the time, about 20,000 iron coins were needed to buy a roll of fabric. A carriage was needed just to buy a roll of fabric. So in order to solve this problem, the world's first paper money, Gyoja, was invented using iron coins as collateral. However, 100 years later, due to the government's over-issuance of money, the world's first paper money disappeared. Once the currency system collapsed, the Song dynasty lost its military and political power and collapsed under the Mongolian invasion. The Yuan dynasty that watched the Song dynasty's fall issued gyocho, based on silver, and created a stable currency system. However, the problem was the endless wars. Every time it faced financial difficulties, the government overissued gyocho, and the currency system collapsed. Once the currency system collapsed, the Yuan dynasty fell like all other empires. The national crisis shook the trust in currency, and the failure of the currency system led to the collapse of an empire. A strong currency and a strong empire were the two pillars that drove history. New York, USA. The Federal Reserve Bank on Wall Street houses the world's largest gold safe. In the 122 gold safes that are located 24 meters underground is gold that other governments, central banks, and international organizations entrusted. After the gold standard disappeared, gold that lost its place to the dollar disappeared into the dark. Then, what backs the value of currency? It's the world's key currency that is the foundation of international trade and transactions. The source of that power is in national strength. The British pound dominated the world's economy for 100 years. And then the US dollar took over. It was the result of the currency war among nations.
Oftentimes, over time in history, you find that as countries change in their economic power, the UK and then the US, reserve currencies change. But I think we're moving to a world where there's a lot more engines of growth, and it makes sense to have multiple reserve currencies. So this is a function not just of the United States, but really of the changing world economy. But it does mean, though, for the United States, if other currencies are used as reserve holdings, then there will be a relative fall in the demand for the dollar as a foreign exchange reserve holding, and that's worrisome if the U.S. has a lot of debt to sell.
The Byzantine bezant, 700 years. The British pound, 100 years. These are the number of years these key currencies dominated the world. Then how much longer will the dollar rule the world? People's fantasy about the dollar shattered in September 2008. The financial crisis that originated from the US left the world in fear, and people immediately rushed to obtain gold. The moment greed turned to fear, the emperor, sleeping in the dark, awoke from its slumber. After 40 years of sleep, gold has returned. The price of gold rose 22 times in 2010, which is a record within a given year. Now the world is rushing out to buy gold. The central banks of each country bought 216 tons of gold just in the first half of 2011. The price of gold is skyrocketing, and the US and the dollar is plunging endlessly.
even before the financial crisis, there were trends underway which made it likely that the U.S. would not play as dominant a role in international finance as it has in recent decades. You had the creation of the euro, a currency for a very large economic area, and the euro was beginning to play a larger role. In addition, you've got the emergence of China, already the second largest economy in the world and growing very rapidly. That makes it natural that over time, as Chinese financial markets develop, as they open up their capital markets, that I think we will see the renminbi play a larger role as well.
Just as it defeated England at the Bretton Woods Conference, defeated France via the Nixon shock, put Germany and Japan under control, will the U.S. be able to win the currency war once again?
Well, the United States is now in relative decline to the rest of the world. As you probably know, the 19th century was the century of the U.K. It went into decline during the 20th century, and it's no longer anywhere near the major economy in the world. The 20th century was the century of the U.S. We're now in relative decline, too. The largest creditor nations in the world now are China, Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore. The assets and the money, the wealth, is in Asia now. The United States is the largest debtor nation, not just the largest debtor nation in the world, we're the largest debtor nation in the history.
Once the U.S., the financial empire built on debt and the power of the dollar, began to shake, the world began to debate about the new key currency. The one that's receiving the most attention is gold, that it has returned after 40 years. Is gold the omnipotent currency that will bring stability back, or is it just a mirage?
Well, the fundamental dilemma for somebody that's thinking of holding gold is that gold does not produce an income. Now, I mentioned art. Art does not produce an income, but it gives you a mental income, it gives you a psychological income. Common stocks, equities, or bonds, they give you a financial income. Gold doesn't do that. What gold does do is it gives you some security.
So as it stands today, we think gold is undervalued by a pretty good margin. We don't know if 10,000 is the target, but we do think that the difference between $1,500 and $10,000 an ounce represents the degree of inflation, true inflation, that we've seen in the currency. Now, if we were to use the same formula that we used from 1945 to 1971, the price of gold would be $10,000 an ounce.
Gold versus the dollar. The currency war has already begun. Gold is stable, but its production is limited. On the other hand, the dollar, with no restriction in production, has lost its stability. The gold standard was discarded 40 years ago after the Nixon shock. Will the era of gold return?
So I don't see gold coming back anytime soon. But if we had a serious crisis and there was nothing else, people might grab for the gold standard. But remember, the gold standard has many flaws as well.
I do not see gold playing an official part of a formal payment system. It's not convenient to exchange. It's not as stable in value as a basket of national currencies.
I think there's a pretty good chance that the gold standard will come back, although timing is a very difficult thing to try to handicap. It may come as a result of policy, but in practical terms, it's probably going to be the marketplace that drives the gold standard back into widespread acceptance.
The new key currency that will follow the British pound of the 19th century and the dollar of the 20th century. The birth of a new key currency begins from people's trust. In the midst of the world economic crisis, we are at a point where we must decide the future key currency.
Gold actually is not a government decision. We use this as a money. I think gold in the history, it's choose is being chosen by the market. People trust gold. So when the people trust that gold or silver, so the government just use that as the money. If that's the case, I think probably in the future or in the current world, probably we should let the market to choose which one is better solution for our current problem.
No one knows which currency to trust and which currency to choose as the key currency. But even at this moment, gold reflects humans' desire most accurately. A soft, yellow, sparkling piece of metal. It is gold that the universe created. But humans gave it power, honor, and immortality. And the destiny of gold changed. Gold has written history for thousands of years, and humanity abandoned gold 40 years ago. But gold has returned. Will the return of gold be a blessing or a disaster? We stand before gold once again.
Well, with increasing political instability inside the U.S. and with the aftermath of the economic meltdown, perhaps the days of the dollar are in decline. And as history has proven to previous empires, when the dollar is out, U.S. dominance around the world will also fade away. Well, that's a wrap for this week. But join me again here next time on Aperture. If you have questions and comments you'd like to share with us, just email or visit our Facebook or Twitter. Goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
In the limelight.
For decades, the U.S. government has ignored the warnings from public health experts that the U.S. was not properly prepared for the pandemic Americans are living through now, says Bob Hennelly, a writer, in an article titled Many U.S. deaths during pandemic were simply due to lack of access to health care. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. In calculating its human toll, a pandemic is similar to a war. The most precise way public health researchers can get a handle on the impact of something like COVID-19 is to compare the number of total deaths recorded in a specific place during the pandemic with death tallies from prior years. That analysis will yield a figure known as excess deaths, which simply means deaths above and beyond what would normally be expected. That figure captures not just COVID-19 deaths, but the number of people who were unable to access health care at a moment in their lives when a chronic condition was becoming life-threatening. It also includes individuals whose primary cause of death may have been something else, but who were also infected by COVID-19. And now that the dust has settled and the data are being tabulated, America's excess death numbers over the past year are staggering. The importance of tabulating such a dark statistic is twofold. Its record-breaking nature is due to both largely for-profit healthcare system as well as U.S. government incompetence. Indeed, for decades, U.S. government ignored the warnings from public health experts that the U.S. was not properly prepared for the pandemic Americans are living through now. It's not like no one could saw the pandemic coming. In his book, The Great Influenza, the first published in 2004, John M. Barry presaged the COVID-19 crisis, describing how hospitals, like every other industry, have gotten more efficient by cutting costs, which means virtually no excess capacity on a per capita basis. The United States has far fewer hospital beds than a few decades ago. He continued, "Indeed, during the routine influenza season, usage of respirators rises to nearly 100%. In a pandemic, most people who needed a mechanical respirator would not get one. As we have learned firsthand over the last several months, because the healthcare system was overwhelmed, getting accurate cause of death data was itself a work in progress. No doubt, huge numbers of cases of COVID-19 may have been missed. In other instances, individuals may have died at home or succumbed to a chronic illness that was written off as COVID when it was not. The one constant comparative data point is death itself from any and all causes. Like birth, deaths are something we track with some precision. Hence, one way that medical researchers can get a sense of the scale of the impact of something like COVID is to compare the total number of deaths from all causes during the pandemic and compare it with the same data point over several prior years." Such an excess death analysis will capture the collateral impact of overwhelmed healthcare systems that were under-resourced long before the pandemic. It will include the people that died as a consequence of opting not to go to the hospital for an unrelated condition for fear of catching COVID-19. While that might not count as a COVID-19 death per se, it tells us something about what happens when we permit healthcare to operate without any margin or redundancy, what is effectively a form of rationing healthcare. According to a recently published study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which looked at the rate of excess deaths from March 1st, 2020 to January 2021, There were 522,368 excess deaths as gauged against averages over the same period from 2014 to 2019. At the start of this year, COVID-19 deaths were reported at just over 350,186 across the U.S. By comparing the excess rate of death with the COVID-19 reported data linked to its location, we can get some sense of whether the public health system had the hardest time holding up under the once-in-a-century strain of a mass death event. The study produced by researchers with the Virginia Commonwealth University School of Medicine in Richmond and the Yale School of Public Health calculated that COVID-19 accounted for 72.4% of the excess mortality. The balance may have been either immediate or delayed mortality from undocumented COVID-19 infection or non-COVID-19 deaths secondary to the pandemic, such as from delayed care or behavioral health crises. While nationally there was a 23% increase in excess mortality during the pandemic, New York State, which lost close to 50,000 to COVID, saw the nation's highest spike with a 38% jump in excess deaths. Though Mississippi and New Jersey actually exceeded New York State on a per capita basis, according to the researchers. In an editorial that was published with the study, Dr. Alan M. Garber wrote of the importance of grasping the bigger picture beyond the daily COVID dashboard. There is no more visible or alarming manifestation of the toll of the COVID-19 pandemic than the deaths it has caused, he noted. The missteps in responding to an outbreak that not only could be, but largely was, predicted should not give governments confidence that they are prepared for threats that are more speculative and possibly further in the future, Garber continued. Failure to anticipate the scale of the potential damage from such future catastrophes will only exacerbate the tendency to downplay their importance, making it less likely that governments will prepare adequately. That is why understanding the toll of a pandemic is an important step in the right direction. In New York City, where COVID killed more than 32,000 city residents, fighting the virus inspired life-saving innovations. It also exposed long-standing healthcare disparities that left some neighborhoods more at the mercy of the highly contagious and deadly virus, according to Dr. Mitch Katz, the CEO of New York City Health Plus Hospitals. NYCH Plus H, the U.S. largest municipal hospital system, includes 11 hospitals and saw some of the highest patient death counts early on. Over the course of the pandemic, thousands of H plus H workers from a myriad of job titles were sidelined by the deadly virus, which took lives of 53 employees. It was on the throes of this nearly unprecedented public health emergency that H plus H found ways to improve patient care while at the same time reducing the exposure of staff to the deadly virus, which helped to slow the spread of the virus. We have done a lot of work from the first wave about putting glass doors in or glass in the walls to create a window for cameras in the patient's rooms, microphones so that patients can be mentioned safely without going into the room, and that is a positive development whether there is COVID or some other infectious disease, Dr. Katz said during a phone interview. So I think we'll learn how to make our hospitals safer for the care of patients with infectious diseases, he continued. For Dr. Katz, one of the most sobering discoveries was how pre-existing disparities in the city's private and public hospital infrastructure left some communities so much more vulnerable during the pandemic. I think the fact that we had so many fewer hospital beds in Queens compared to Manhattan was one of the stark lessons, he said. Dr. Katz established a national reputation leading the public hospital systems in San Francisco and Los Angeles before returning home to New York. After years of experience on the front lines of urban healthcare on both coasts, he believes that the nation's vulnerability to COVID-19 can be traced back to steady disinvestment in public health that started during the Reagan era. As the city, state, and federal governments across the U.S. attempt to regroup after the death of more than a half million and the infection of well over 30 million, Dr. Katz believes policymakers would be well advised to consult the data not just on COVID death per se, but on excess mortality rates referenced by neighborhoods. He said, absolutely, and I think we have some sense already of the excess mortality that occurred both among people who had COVID and didn't come forward for testing, he added. Some of those people were undocumented immigrants or people who were very low income and feared coming forward to a hospital.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to the debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has expressed concern over the violence that Bahraini security forces have inflicted on prisoners at the Job prison in Manama. This after prisoners initiated a peaceful sit-in complaining about their treatment and the neglect of another political prisoner, which led to his death. After more than a decade of protests by the Bahraini people, the regime continues with its brutal attack against the people of this country, both inside of prisons and out.
Protests are growing in Bahrain inside and outside prison walls, so is the regime crackdown. On Friday, the UN Human Rights Office described as disturbing the Bahraini regime's use of force to break up a peaceful sit-in at the country's main prison mid-April. OICHR slammed as unnecessary and disproportionate the violent repression of the sit-in at Jao prison located south of the capital, Manama. The inmates have been demonstrating against detention conditions, particularly the lack of access to medical treatment. The sit-in started in early April after the death of a political prisoner due to reportedly being denied timely access to essential health care. Outside the prison, Bahrainis have been holding similar protests, calling for the release of political prisoners and better conditions. OICHR says the lack of healthcare in overcrowded Bahraini prisons has been an issue for years, which has turned into a chronic problem due to the coronavirus pandemic. It says Manama's response to protests has been in the form of more detentions. Thousands of opposition politicians, activists, journalists, and human rights defenders have been imprisoned in Western allied Bahrain since an uprising in 2011 and subsequent years of crackdown.
The Bahraini regime has been clamping down very viciously on these political prisoners that have been protesting against appalling conditions in Bahraini prisons. These are, in fact, political prisoners. It's important to emphasize because these are people that had protested very peacefully back in 2011. demanding political reforms, democratic rights and human rights, and even citizenship rights. They've been protesting not only against the appalling conditions that exist there, but these conditions have been worsened as a consequence of the pandemic.
Bahrain's most prominent cleric, Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Qassem, says drawing up a new constitution is the only way out of the political crisis. He has urged the regime to pursue an agreement with the opposition instead of increasingly suppressing the dissidents. That advice is likely to fall on deaf ears, given over 10 years of crackdown. However, with every protest chipping away at the legitimacy and authority of the Al-Khalifa regime, it is only fast-tracking the inevitable, which cannot be suppressed.
I'd like to welcome my first guest out of Washington, D.C., author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman. Michael, great to have you with us. Now, Michael, we look at the situation in Bahrain. I mean, what is it about the regime? Why is the regime so repressive against the people there? What is it trying to get to?
Well, it's trying desperately to hold on to power, and it's been backed by Saudi Arabia and the United States since the beginning of the protest 10 years ago, with the Saudis invading the country to help crack down on people who wanted a better way of life and a little bit of democracy. And of course, the United States supports it militarily and financially, using it as the base for the Fifth Fleet that sails the Persian Gulf instead of the American Gulf. And there are some 20,000 soldiers, sailors, and Marines there. And the Americans love this, and it puts money in the coffers. It's propped up the Al-Khalifa dynasty. So if this were taken away, the country would collapse, if you can call it a country. It's basically a city with some dirt around it. And there wouldn't be any more Khalifas, there wouldn't be any more overcrowded prisons, there wouldn't be any more beatings, there wouldn't be any more killings. But unfortunately, nobody will do anything about it. It's like the weather. You always talk about it, but you don't do anything about it.
And let's look at the other side of the coin, Michael, because on the one hand, we have the regime, which is behaving so oppressively. On the other hand, we have, as far as those countries that they're giving this regime full support, we're talking about, especially these Western countries like the United States or like the UK. What's in it for them? Why are they supporting this repressive regime?
Well, one, of course, it's value for money. They sell weapons and other sorts of arms and ammunition and things to the Khalifas to control their country. And also, it's used as a base against Iran. It's one of the many bases that the Americans have built encircling the country. And they see the Fifth Fleet sailing up and down the Persian Gulf as a way of controlling Iran and keeping Iran from exercising even a modicum amount of control in the region there, in the water. They scream bloody murder every time a couple of motorboats sail within a couple of hundred meters of an American warship. So it's again, it's money for the merchants of death, and it's control, political control, and economic control aimed at Iran.
Welcome my next guest out of London from Islamic Human Rights Commission, Reza Qassem. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, Reza, why do we not see more forceful language being used by this UN office? Now, it said it is disturbed by what has happened in the prison in Manama, but it doesn't seem to hold it responsible or demand any type of action. Your take on that?
I think one of the things that we need to recognize that the United Nations is often limited by the powers like Britain, like America, who have particular influences that they bring to bear on Bahrain and what they want to do. And so when that kind of control is there, it makes it very difficult for the United Nations officials to be able to say the things that really should be said. It's quite clear what has gone on. It is unacceptable. It is clearly problematic and so on. So there are some serious issues in terms of that that need to be addressed. But this is a historical problem. This is something that has been going on in Bahrain for a number of years, where Britain would actually try to be the champion of democracy and lecture people around the world, when in fact it's ex-British police officers and MI6 agents and so on have been involved and managing the torture of people in Bahrain, anyone who rises up or says something against the government. And this is something that goes back decades in terms of how Britain has actually been playing a very dirty role on the ground, and people from official places like the MI6 or like the police and so on, or ex-police officers and so on, are directly involved in managing how this is actually controlled and what actually happens on the ground in terms of the regime and legitimizing the regime and the managing when things of this ilk actually happen. So this is going back in terms of the stuff that happens for quite some time. So it's not surprising in a sense.
Well, Michael, the majority of these prisoners are political prisoners, meaning they're activists, they're former politicians, they're academics, etc. And we don't see or hear a whole lot. I mean, they're being basically incarcerated due to their beliefs. But, I mean, when we look at a situation, for example, we have a situation right now in Russia where an individual, the West is calling him a political prisoner, or it could be other places like Venezuela or Iran, and we see what they do when they talk about political prisoners. But we have these individuals, and so many of them, that are in Bahraini jails, but nothing is being done. Why?
Well, first off, as you mentioned, the people that are being targeted by the United States and the European Union, such as President Putin of Russia and Maduro in Venezuela and the Castros in Cuba, they want the American government wants these people overthrown. They want the legitimate government of Iran overthrown and replaced by governments friendly to the West, governments that will do the bidding of the apartheid entity that styles itself Israel. But God forbid that anyone should question the so-called allies of the United States, the organizations and countries that facilitate the operation of the American imperium around the world. Bahrain is one great example of this. Without Manama as the home port of the American Fifth Fleet, the Americans would have a substantial loss of control in the region. So they pick and they choose. They support human rights when they want to overthrow a government or gain political influence. They turn a blind eye to places like Iran and Saudi Arabia and the apartheid entity when they engage in murder, war crimes, and human rights violations because it's in their interest. They have friends, they have people that will give them influence, that will do translations and dirty work and things like this. And therefore, the Americans love that.
Well, Reza, we have witnessed protests on and off now for over a decade in Bahrain. Do you think that there has been any progress regarding human rights in that country, or has the situation deteriorated?
I think over that period of time, it would be fair to say that things have actually deteriorated quite considerably. And I think what is further telling within all of this, that while there was some kind of lip service that was being paid initially to what was going on, being unacceptable, gradually over a period of time, this has actually changed, and there is indifference towards political indifference, no political will, and no kind of desire to hide their indifference. And
why is that? Let me just jump in here, Reza. You said no desire to even hide their indifference. So what does that mean? Does that mean there's absolutely no accountability, not obviously inside the country and not from international entities? Your take.
Yeah, so within the country, it's even things like where you've got medical concerns of individual prisoners, and we've seen that whether it's cancer cases, whether it's the corona or issues to do with that, whether it's looking after people who have got medical conditions, all of that has been used as a weapon. So it's been weaponized to deliberately ignore those symptoms, those problems, and those issues to make sure that those people's conditions actually worsen. So it's a systematic problem. It's a systemic problem. So at any level of humanity, you know, in terms of basic humanity and human rights or humanitarian kind of issues that are raised by these things, you would have expected that there would have been an outcry regarding making sure that those people got the treatment, were treated, and had their legitimate medical needs and so on met. But there's been a systemic and systematic abuse of that within, and no kind of calling out of this on the international level by either the British government or the American government. And to not even do that is clearly a signal of what's they don't care, and they're not worried about the fact that they are seen to not care. And I think it's those kind of things that suggest that there is very little accountability of by them of the Bahraini regime and what it's doing, and also their minions in terms of British police officers that are on the ground in Bahrain managing some of these things in terms of what's actually going on, managing the publicity around this and so on and so forth. So all of these things are very much intertwined, and I think that lack of accountability on the international level is also a problem and needs to be recognized mm-hmm. and called out for what it is. I mean, they don't care, and they don't care that they are shown to not care either. And I think the solutions need to the problems in Bahrain will need to be coming from elsewhere, because if you're looking for the West to provide those solutions, it's not going to happen. They need to be coming. New thought needs to be given to that.
Okay. Well, Michael, originally protests called for political reforms through peaceful demonstrations, but the regime could not even tolerate that. So what do you make of this? And so what are the options? I mean, Reza just said that there has to be some new thought about basically help is not coming from the outside. So what needs to happen in your perspective?
Well, what needs to happen is that the United Nations has got to stop talking and wringing its hands about how things are bad there. The United States State Department's report on human rights on Bahrain for last year goes through a litany of its crimes against the people and its repression to the point where in prison you're not safe because you're beaten, you have poor medical care, and so forth. I think that short of an armed invasion of Bahrain, as the United Nations sanctioned in Korea in the early 1950s, and then in the 90s in Yugoslavia and in Iraq, nothing's going to be done. You've got to point out exactly what's happening. You've got to get the international news media to break their ties with government and point out exactly what is being done to the people of Bahrain by the American-supported government, by the British-supported government, and we've got to really point the finger and publicize this. Certainly publicizing what went on in South Africa brought an end to apartheid, and if you can get the news media to do the same thing in Israel or the same thing with Bahrain, it might be another story, but that's a big task, and you've got to persuade these corporate giants that it's in their interest to report the news factually and carefully and accurately.
Well, Reza, Sheikh Isa Qasim, the main religious leader, of course, of Bahrain, says a new constitution is the only way to end the repression in that country. Your take on that, and what would it take for that to happen?
I think in terms of the new constitution and so on, I can't see the Bahraini authorities agreeing to that, because that would mean limiting the powers that the king would have, limiting the powers that would be had in order to continue the oppression that they are doing in terms of meeting the needs and the aspirations of the Bahraini people. So while this is a legitimate demand, and I think it's appropriate that something like this is instigated and done and provides an alternative about what the way forward could be, and it says very clearly to people looking into Bahrain internationally that, look, there are solutions on the ground that are legitimate, that are valid, and all of those things are there, I think it's very appropriate that something like that is happening. But at the same time, don't hold your breath that this is going to be something that's going to be, they're going to roll over and allow that to be done and the new constitution to be brought in, because it will be, to, you know, which oppressor would like their powers to be limited in any way? Which person, megalomaniac, is going to want to have their powers limited? And that's simply not going to happen. And
so, you said that another thought process, sorry to interrupt you, I'm just so limited in time, but you said another thought process, Reza, has to be taken into consideration. Because as I said earlier, repeating what you said, that the help is not going to come from those Western powers or the so-called international agency that's supposed to be dealing with human rights. So what's the answer in your perspective? What has to be done?
So I think it's a multitude of things that need to happen. I mean, if there are people sitting outside, I mean, it's looking at grassroots, it's looking at institutional links with Bahrain. So whether it's academic, whether it's on the sporting field, whether it's any of those kind of things that can, so whether it's Formula One that goes there, targeting those people and those kind of things to actually say, you need to rein back, you need to pull out, because this is, you, what you're doing is supporting a regime which is oppressive and so on and so forth. So I think at one level, it's got to be that. At the grassroots level within Bahrain, we need to think about, you know, it's like any oppressive system or any oppressive government. Are they going to roll over? They're not, unless you give them and make them an offer and provide them the resistance that is required to make them realize that an alternative offer is actually worthwhile in terms of taking, and think about how that resistance needs to be manifested. So that there is one level in terms of demonstrations, in terms of all of these things that are going to be taking place on the ground, and they have been happening for years and decades in some senses, in terms of what's been going on. Obviously, with the whole 2011 and where it started, that was, there was an intensity that was created after that period of time that it was going on for. But I think obviously all of these things will continue, but I think another angle in terms of whether looking at resistance in a different kind of form might be an option that needs to be looked at. So I think that I would say that people need to look at those options. And when those options are on the table, the government will start to think, okay, is it really going to be worth my while to take on a resistance that is going to be much more assertive and aggressive in what they do?
Okay, and on that note, appreciate you being with us, both of you, actually. Author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman, out of Washington, D.C., always a pleasure, Michael, and Islamic Human Rights Commission, Reza Kazem, out of London. Thank you so much. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.